Asset Manager of the Greenberg Global Macro Hedge Fund. Good morning, Albert.
Good morning.
Good morning. On behalf of both of us, on behalf of Niagara Capital Partners and Greenberg Mercantile Group, good morning to investors in North America, Europe, and Asia. What we're going to do is follow our usual format, which is to say that I'm going to act as a kind of interlocutor, putting Al to a couple of questions. And then afterwards, if there's time, we're going to open the line up to questions from our listeners. If you have any questions, I'd invite you to email them to erott@niagaracapital.ca. That's E-R-O-T-T at niagaracapital.ca. The fund, if for those of you who've read our second quarterly report, had another rather choppy quarter. It was down 7% at the end of the second quarter. We've had a good July for those of you who are investors in the fund, and we expect, as of this day, we'll be close to even. Of the five pockets, the two that gave us the most difficulty were in the currency area and in the equity market neutral area. See how it is that we're going to achieve our goal, which is to say of earning positive returns on a rolling 12-month basis. We'll begin with Al by talking about the summary that he makes at the end of the quarterly report, in which he assesses the current economic situation to be an expectation of a global recovery, but that international inflation pressures will intensify in months ahead. This is largely a result of the world having to deal with a surplus of unwanted dollar reserves. These surplus dollars will serve, as he says in the quarterly report, I'm quoting from it, the Archimedes point in the global monetary system, leveraging global money supply. We expect that foreign stock markets will perform well. We don't expect the same to be the case of the United States. Al, could you elaborate on this, please?
Okay. Our view has been that the U.S. is the central focus of this enormous monetary expansion that's taking place around the world. Let me start by explaining the following. Until about 2 years ago, so the U.S. Was in the midst of a boom. Consumption was clearly exceeding savings by a large margin. And we were drawing the expression of that excess spending was the very large current account deficit that the U.S. was running. It was something in the order of 7% of GDP, a very large current account deficit. This current account deficit, which is we were drawing on savings, foreign savings, was being financed particularly by most of the major financial centers around the world. A lot of Asian countries especially, and it's not until about sometime in 2007 that we experienced the beginnings of a recession and then the beginnings of a rise in domestic savings. As domestic savings rose, our current account deficit began to of course narrow. That's a very important indicator. That's like almost like you have a thermometer and you can tell. It's not something that will, it's something that will tell you that you have temperature. Well, the current account deficit of 7% of GDP is extremely high. It's like 104 degrees, maybe on your thermometer. But as the U.S. entered the recession and savings rates increased, this deficit, this dependence, this reliance on foreign savings began to decrease. Now, what happened here is that, unfortunately, I should say, for the world's global picture, the U.S. Attempted in many different ways to abort this severe adjustment. And so we have we had a tremendous push on the fiscal side. We had a tremendous push on the monetary side where interest rates were lowered to practically zero, where the monetary base was expanded at astronomical annual rates. The purpose of these moves, fiscal and monetary, was simply to rev up the motor to have the consumer increase once again spending forget about saving, increase spending, forget saving. So I say it's unfortunate because any other country experiences this kind of persistent chronic current account deficit. Comes a point that it cannot finance itself anymore. And the prescription is, of course, you need now to tighten your belt and you need now to finance your own spending. And so most countries will undergo a very severe, severe recession where consumption sharply curtailed. That was not the case in the U.S. So what we have experienced till now is sort of like a semi-adjustment, an incomplete, an aborted adjustment. And it's true the savings rate in the U.S. has risen, but a lot of it is now being made up by spending on the fiscal side. So it's probable that our current account deficit is now in the order of maybe 3% of GDP or maybe 2.5 to 3% the deficit of GDP. The problem is that that's still too large, meaning there is an unwillingness on the part of international central banks to continue to finance, and maybe of not just central banks, but even private participants, to continue to finance this extraordinary deficit, and it's chronic. It's been going on for 20, 30 years now. And so many of these central banks have now reached the practical limit of their dollar holdings, which is causing problems for them too, in addition to the fact that they are feeling a little bit uncomfortable. They're feeling quite uncomfortable. Chinese have expressed that very clearly. They're very uncomfortable with owning so many dollars and so many dollar securities. But it's also causing problems for them because forming the base for expansion of money around the world. As central banks acquire these dollars, they actually create a local currency which now expands around the world. So the U.S. is the central motor for this huge monetary inflation that's taking place around the world. Other economies which have not had the same excess spending problem as the U.S. have recovered remarkably fast. The Chinese have recovered fairly quickly, but so is most of Asia. Europe is in some parts of Asia, or Europe already are recovering. Only two or three countries in Europe which had excesses, big excesses, Spain, Ireland, are still in a deep recession. But other parts of Europe, like Germany, are starting to do much, much better. And Latin America, Brazil is recovered fairly well. So what we're seeing is that the rest of the world can recover. That means that they are now bidding for commodities, and we're seeing commodity prices increase across the board. It is not correct to focus your attention on the U.S. and be skeptical of the commodity price increases, because the U.S. is today only a smaller part of the total picture. So our scenario calls for a rapidly rising commodity prices around the world as demand increases for them. At the same time, the U.S., we think, will continue to perform subpar in relation to the rest of the world, but not subpar enough to complete the adjustment, which, as I said before, it's an unfortunate matter from an adjustment point of view. That means that the U.S., to the extent that the U.S. is weak or relatively weak, we're going to see the central bank in the U.S. continue a very accommodative policy, a very easy money policy. Fiscal policy will continue to be fairly accommodating to the business cycle. The moment that the U.S. comes out of its weak state and begins to recover in positive terms, which may not be far off, but it won't be a very strong recovery. it will not be positive for its own markets. In other words, the U.S. will only do well, or relatively well at least, its markets will do relatively well provided, its equity markets will do relatively well provided it is not in full recovery. Full recovery means that very large deficits have to be financed and they have to compete with private demand for capital. The competition between private sector and public sector will cause interest rates to skyrocket in the U.S., especially in long-term rates. And so the U.S. is best off from a stock market point of view, and that's from a human point of view, of course, is best off to be weak, to be relatively weak in economic terms. So as long as we see that, and that's still there, because the statistics that we get recently show that we've had some deceleration in the rate of decline, but we still don't have we don't have positive numbers across the board. So that remains still fairly constructive for the equity market. But we will be reaching an inflection point very soon, and when we do, that will start creating some problems in the U.S. as I said before. We are positioned to take advantage of the international demand for commodities. We are also positioned to take advantage of at least one of the emerging markets. We've had an increase in our position in China. And we are playing the one sector that we think is still very inexpensive. It's the H shares in Hong Kong. Via these two, and of course, we now continue to maintain a very strong position in gold, representing between 55 and 60% of assets. And we feel that that's getting very close to another breakout to new levels. I believe that very soon we'll see gold vault over the $1,000 barrier, and we should be considerably higher within the next six to nine months. So we are positioned for that. Some of the other pockets are positioned for a little bit more inflation. We're still long tips, which means that we're still saying that it's best to own treasuries that are indexed to inflation, because inflation will be a little higher than expected by the market, and which means that we are able to buy these securities still at a decent price. They are break evens, which is really the difference between the nominal interest rates and the inflation index interest rates, are still reasonable. We are able to buy 10-year paper at what looks like an average expected inflation rate of 1.5% a year, which we think is too low. So that's another area of concentration for the fund. And then, of course, we have two pockets that are sort of independent in that sense from that overall picture. One of them is the currency account, currency trading area, which has been reduced. We lowered a few months ago the exposure from 10% to 5%. Our target is now 5% of the portfolio, but we reduced it because of that tension that was developing in the foreign exchange market, which we saw coming, but we didn't actually realize how damaging it could be. And the tension has to do with the fact that the U.S. dollar is, in fact, cheap. The dollar is cheap on a purchasing power basis relative to the rest of the world. But the other side of it is that nobody wants dollars anymore. This excess dollar production, these piling deficits, these accumulating deficits, are making the dollar an unwanted currency. So you have a dilemma between cheapness, value and cash flow in a way. And nobody wants the dollars, and so we, for a good part of the first half of the year, we were betting that the cheapness feature would prevail, and that the dollar would actually do better than it did. It didn't. and made a decision then in just in recent weeks that we would not really be too much involved in the dollar area. We rather be involved in some more interesting cross operations, in which we have started doing, and we started doing better in that sector. The in the equity portfolio, where we are, where we carry a balanced long short position. We had made a great deal of money the year before because we had a large concentration on the short side of financials, and this year we thought that financials had gone down maybe enough, and that there was the time to balance that position. So instead of actually covering all the financial positions, all the short positions, what we did is we went long some other ones, and so we ended up being long some, short some. We got long Goldman Sachs at a very good price in the 60s, and remained short some other ones. And unfortunately, though, the net balance remains still a little bit on the short side. And it affected that portfolio. By now, that section of the portfolio, the financial sector portfolio, has been reduced considerably. There's not a lot there, and we found some other interesting areas. We still like housing. We're very excited about housing. We think that the real debacle, the real depression housing, is basically behind us, or at least behind us in terms of the prices of the securities. It may take a little longer, but the price of the securities have already discounted the greatest depression in 50 or 60 years, or maybe 100 years. We're also excited about the biotechnology sector, which keeps producing interesting possibilities for big pharma, and big pharma is got very little. There are very few avenues left but to purchase these companies, where most of the new ideas have flourished. And you know, here and there we have some individual bets on small sectors like oil and drilling and things of that sort. But we think that the equity sector is now well positioned to do well and to actually capitalize on what we think is now increasing dispersion in the market. The early stages of a bull market, or the early stages of a gigantic bear market rally, however you like to call it, are very indiscriminate. Almost everything goes up, and in fact, the early stages, what you see going up the most are stocks that went down the most, and the bounces are greatest there, or companies that have had the largest short positions. It's only after 3, 4, 5 months that you get to see some discrimination develop, and some of the more constructive sectors begin to outperform the ones that have the least favorable expectations. We think we're entering that period, and therefore we think that since we are value-oriented and we look at momentum, both things, that we would actually benefit from this coming phase in the market. I think that's an overall wrap-up.
Thank you. Let me give you a bit of a break here. By turning just for a minute, if we could, to the big macro theme of interest rates, you're speaking. You have two, not one, but two reasons to expect higher interest rates. One is the funding of government deficits, and the other is ultimately a rising interest rate scenario to protect a dollar catastrophe. I don't know if catastrophe is too strong a word, but a dollar collapse. When we experienced the demise of what's now popularly referred to as Bretton Woods II. These dual influences seem to, or at least sound as though they may have the makings of a perfect storm. Are we expecting very sharply higher rates, and where on the curve will they take place if that's the scenario? And how does that affect your positioning in the one pocket that you haven't spoken about so far, which is the fixed income pocket, where you have a very highly concentrated position in TIPS.
Okay, that's a good point, David. There are two reasons why we expect interest rates to go up. One of them, of course, is the inevitable collision of the U.S. government borrowing enormous amounts of money. Their deficit this year will be equal to maybe 14%, and maybe some numbers go as high as 21% of GDP. But assuming something a little more conservative, 14% of GDP is an enormous burden on the money markets. If there was private demand for capital. As it is now, there's very little private demand, and so therefore the government is still able to borrow these monies without affecting too much the level of interest rates. The deficits are large. The question it will be, because a lot of that deficit was funded by foreign central banks, the question will be, will they continue to do that? And if they don't, what happens to rates? And so we think that the long-term rates will rise. For instance, today we have a 2 to 30 year yield spread of somewhere like 10 to 50 basis points. If the Fed continues to maintain an artificially low interest rate, that spread can widen to 400, 450, maybe 500 basis points. But inevitably, we will find that as rates go up, the pressures on the Fed will intensify, and they will see that persisting at maintaining artificial rates will not work. And so I expect that at some point, and this is the key, this is really an important point. I mean, we have to keep this in mind. The Fed understands today very well that the Greenspan Fed made a mistake by maintaining rates too low. I think that that's today the accepted wisdom, even though Greenspan has fought against it and even Bernanke has fought against it for some time. But it's now clear that one of the great causes of the boom, the uncontrollable boom, was the fact that the Fed maintained rates too low. I believe that the Fed has partially learned this lesson, partially. And when I say partially, it's because I think that they still maintain, even at this time, a artificially low rate, and they're likely to maintain this rate as a way to stimulate the economy, and that's, again, not something, it's not relevant to this discussion. I mean, it's deserves an entirely different discussion. What should be the interest rate that the U.S. should keep, or should it be a floating rate, or should be a rate determined only by market forces? That's a separate question. And I want to get into this kind of discussion now, but it's clear that the U.S. will persist with low rates, is persisting now with low rates that are lower than they should be. It probably will do that until we see a turn in the employment picture. The general opinion of market observers is that the Fed will begin to tighten once they see the economy recover, and to see the economy recover means once they see employment increase. That may still be some time off, but one thing is clear to me, at least, is that when that happens, I think the Fed will move faster, much faster than it did in 2004 or 2005. And chances are that the Fed will move in larger, much larger increments, so that we should be prepared, because the Fed will come in and raise rates at maybe half points or maybe three-quarter of a point increments to try to regain control of monetary policy. You know, the Fed has expressed now an opinion, and I believe it's true, that they have the tools to manage the exit, meaning they have increased the monetary base by a large proportion. That monetary base increase can spill into very, very rapid rates of money supply increases. The Fed has explained that they have the tools to be able to control that, and there's no doubt that they do. By paying interest rates on reserves, they can easily avoid that spillage, that leakage into increases in money supply. But it will require a very aggressive monetary policy to do that. And it's not a question of whether they have the tools, it's a question of whether they have the willingness to do it. And I think that they have the willingness, but the willingness is not willing to do it early enough. I think that they want to do it when they can actually have employment increases staring them at the face, and that's when they're going to do it. Nevertheless, long-term rates, until such time, will continue to increase. That itself will put pressure on the Fed. There will be less and less buying by foreign central banks of our longer-term treasuries. They will start concentrating on short-term maturities. And so we are going to see a large increase in the spread between short-term rates and long-term rates until the Fed regains control of money supply of monetary policy. That now has some bearing on the on our position in the fixed income area, where right now we're still positioned, as I said before, in inflation-linked securities. And that's because we feel that any rise in rates is going to be a reflection, or was going to be a reflection of inflation. It actually is starting to become a little bit more problematic, this position. Slowly, the rise in rates will become more a premium on the dollar. It will become more a rate that has to rise in order to stem a decline of the dollar. If that happens, in effect, we're talking about then an increase in real rates. And if we get an increase in real rates, although it's really risk related, but if it's simply in simple terms is an increase in real rates, that will affect also our long-term position in TIPS. And therefore, we at some point in the next few months, as break-even levels rise to a level that we think it's reasonable and no longer attractive, we will be disposing of that position and probably moving a lot of our money market activity to the short floating rate end of the market.
I'm going to turn to the questions now. I think I have one that's quite appropriate following on the heels of this discussion. Before I do, I realize I've been remiss in not mentioning that today is, this is for recording purposes, that today is Monday, July 27th. I have a question from an investor in Europe. I'm going to read it to you, Al. I have only one question, but I think it's very relevant. It seems that Mr. Freeberg is convinced that the massive intervention of governments and central banks is leading to inflation and higher interest rates. What data back up that conviction? I ask this because I keep receiving report after report analyzing the present world financial situation that come up with the conclusion that the amount of leverage and liquidity subtracted by the crisis is so much bigger than the amount being added and, for the most part, not flowing into the broad economy, that a deflationary process is more probable, and that the investor goes on to say that he's witnessing this occurring in Europe. Your scenario calls for the opposite. I think that perhaps the numbers is the place to begin to argue against the question.
Okay, I don't have numbers right now in front of me, and I think he raises a good point, a valid point. But I think that you want to make a difference between credit and money in the U.S. especially, and in Europe too, to a lesser degree. Credit is being restricted. Credit to the private sector is being restricted, and the extension of credit, because it's contracting, or at least it's stationary, because of that, we are seeing a downward pressure on activities that require credit, in particular real estate. Real estate is an activity that has always been built on credit, availability of credit, and this is causing let's call this quote-unquote deflationary pressures in the real estate market. There are many areas that are not, and there are many economies that are not as dependent on credit. The Asian economies are not as dependent on credit. And so to a great extent, many of these Asian economies are actually lenders in some sense, but they're not borrowers. The increases in money for them are actually being reflected in increases in monetary balances of per capita. So that credit problems are not affecting them in such a big way. They are affecting the U.S., there's no question about that, but with the extraordinary contraction that we've had, for instance, the credit in the U.S., we don't see negative inflation numbers. I mean, we had, I think it's a one-month year-over-year situation, but if you look at the first in the past 6 months when credit restrictions have been the strongest, the most powerful, inflation has not been negative. And that's because money is still growing. This is different than, for instance, in the 30s, when the contraction of credit implied a contraction of money. This is not happening here. So this credit cycle will last for some time, especially in the U.S., next to that in Europe. And but when it ends, and by the way, we're not seeing drops in credit of 25%. We're seeing just probably a flattening of credit, at least at the banking level, not at the secondary level, but at the banking level. When this stops, then you're going to see a reemergence of more pressure from the money side. All along, money is increasing, and increases in money eventually get reflected into much higher inflation rates. And when you look at increases of money, for instance, you're looking at China, where money supply has increased upwards of 30% per annum. In many other countries, money supply has increased at a very, very fast rate, so that those numbers guarantee that you're going to have inflationary pressures right through the entire globe by way of international trade.
I see.
Yeah. Is the portfolio positioned in the immediate term or in the long term in anticipation of a dollar crisis, or am I using a term that's too dramatic and really it's a condition that we're looking at that's much more nuanced and more subtle than to refer to it as a crisis?
Good, David. That is true. It's not. It is much more nuanced than that. We're not betting on a dollar crisis. What we're saying is that these conditions, if they persist, can lead to some heavy selling of the dollar. We will need to find a solution to the overhang, the dollar overhang, and I don't know whether there will be a crisis that will force that solution, or will be found by the market, or will be found by enlightened governments who will realize what they have to do at the right time. We're not necessarily betting on a dollar crisis. What we're saying is that these conditions are not conducive to a strong dollar, and they are conducive to a situation where many international players and the central banks are the largest. Will want to part with their dollar holdings and try to use them in some other way. And by the way, the creation of sovereign wealth funds for the Middle Eastern countries, for China, for Brazil, for all these countries is a reflection of their desperation almost in just holding conservative holdings that the central banks have. In other words, 50 years ago, you would have never had a central bank think of anything but short-term, the highest quality government paper for their holdings. Well, it's true that that's the case, but what they have decided to do now is to say, well, let's remove them some part of it. Let's remove 10% or 15% of these reserves. They're anyway very excessive. They're very large. And put them aside in sovereign wealth funds and let those sovereign wealth funds do anything and everything. this is a reflection of the frustrations that they're having. And it's very, very interesting, because as these pools of capital get larger and larger, as these central bank holdings get larger and larger, the determination of how much should go into wealth funds, sovereign wealth funds, will also change. And from maybe 10 to 15%, which were modest steps in the beginning, it may become 25 and 30% and maybe 40%, because, you know, Brazil doesn't need $200 billion of reserves. Even with a foreign exchange crisis, they wouldn't need $200 billion of reserves. So they can set aside maybe $50 billion, maybe $75 billion. If this happens on a worldwide scale, you're talking about an enormous buying power of equities, of commodities, of anything that is not dollar-denominated. And so I'm not, you know, I don't think that we need to talk about dollar crisis. We need to see just these numbers and these flows and these conditions, and then we realize where we should be. You know, I hope that they can find a way to solve the dollar overhang. It took a long time to try to solve the sterling overhang at the turn of the last century, and it didn't work well. And sterling, of course, went down from, I think it was 486, went down to 250, and now it's 160 or 170. So it's gone down a long way, because there was no way to shake off these balances. Nobody knew what to do with them. And maybe we won't know what to do with these dollar balances, perhaps. So this could lead to a crisis. But we're not betting on that. It's much more nuanced than you're right.
We have time for one more question, and it concerns the Canadian dollar. Do you have a take on it?
Yeah, the Canadian dollar is behaving well. It's a commodity currency. At least it's perceived as a commodity currency, and it and the Australian dollar and even the New Zealand dollar have performed well, and I think will continue to perform well on the back of stronger commodity markets. Macro numbers are also healthier looking than the U.S. You know, there's a much smaller deficit. So it's not impossible to see the Canadian dollar trade at some point at par or above par. And but, you know, so will all commodity currencies do well in this type of environment. You know, so we for our Canadian funds we have hedged that Canadian exposure. They are Canadians, and even if we made a 15% return, but the Canadian dollar went up 20%, they would be losing money. They would be calling us and saying, "But what have you done for us?" So what we did is in the upper 70s, and we basically hedged the Canadian dollar, and that worked out well for Canadian investors. I wish we had done the same thing for our U.S.-based investors, because it wouldn't have been a hedge, but it would have made a lot of money.
Okay, let's summarize. We are long. The fund is long gold. Has a heavy exposure to commodities generally, with a concentration specifically in gold. On the equity side, we're not particularly favorably disposed to the U.S. What we do like is the Chinese H shares. We are nervously, or I wouldn't say nervously, we are presently long TIPS, but we have a keen eye on the long end of the interest rate curve. We have we see quite a bit of dispersion now occurring in the equity sector, which should help us in our equity to market neutral pocket. And we've reduced our currency exposure from 10% to 5%, at least for the time being, and focused that area in crosses and not really taken a U.S. dollar position. On behalf of Niagara Capital and Friedberg Mercantile Group, I'd like to thank Al for his time today, and to all investors for listening in. An audio replay of today's call will be posted on our website, and you're invited to go there. Edwin Rott will send all listeners a link to that website. Wish you good investing and a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Al.